I am not a fan of the hard sell. You know what I mean, right? It happens when you walk into a showroom or a store and you're met by an aggressive, high-pressure salesman. In fact, that is the dictionary definition of hard sell. You're coerced to buy something right now without thinking about it, without comparing it to other similar items. Some salesmen won't let you leave until you've made a decision to purchase. And you know, some Christians and some churches are that way when it comes to evangelism. They're so keen on bringing others to Christ, and that is a good thing, all right? No mistaking about that. But they can become pushy. And that usually tends to push people away rather than toward the Savior. So I'm glad to announce this morning that Jesus was not that way. If anything, he was sometimes the exact opposite of the hard sell. And we're going to see one such incident this morning. Oh yes, he invited the people of his day, as well as in our own day, to come, to follow him, to be his disciple, his follower. But he did not want hasty, emotional decisions. If anything, Jesus said, come, but think it over first. Luke 14 records a time when Jesus was at the home of a prominent Pharisee. They had had a dinner together. And in verse 25, we're told that afterwards, large crowds were following Jesus. And it is here that we see the uncompromising demand Jesus makes. Beginning in verse 25. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus. And turning to them, he said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Yes, Jesus had large crowds that were following him, but he was not really impressed with their enthusiasm. He knew that most of the crowd was there only to see the next miracle, or maybe to be fed like the 5,000 were on the hillside. Some even thought maybe this is the one that will kick out the Romans and we will be free once again. He knew that their intentions were not the best. They were expecting the wrong things. He was, in fact, disturbed by his own popularity. That's a rarity, isn't it? Someone that is uncomfortable with that kind of limelight. He knew that much of the crowd's enthusiasm was superficial. And he had no wish for them to be swept off of their feet with a rush of irresponsible emotion. And so Jesus turns to the crowd, and he makes it very clear that if you want to be his disciple, there's going to be a cost. And really what he was doing here was thinning out the ranks. He wanted to get to those who were serious about following him and weed out the ones who had other agendas. You see, with Jesus, when it comes to discipleship, he is much more interested in quality than he is quantity. And I think churches today need to appreciate that as well. It's not all about the numbers. It's about the depth. It's about the quality of one's faith. Now, this is clearly an invitation. If anyone comes to me, but to what are folks invited? Jesus was inviting them and us today to be his disciples. So what is a disciple? Simply put, a disciple is a learner. One who attaches himself to a teacher in order to learn a trade or a subject. I believe in our culture, the best synonym for a disciple is the word apprentice. Think about an apprentice. First, they watch. Then they begin to imitate with the teacher right there, making sure they don't do something catastrophic. And eventually, they learn it well enough that they can go and do it themselves. That's the idea of a disciple, an apprentice. And this word disciple is the most common term used in the Bible for followers of Jesus. It is seen 264 times in the four Gospels and in the book of Acts. Now, sometimes we limit that and we say, oh, he's talking about the 12, right? The 12 disciples. Or maybe we'll include the bigger group, the 70. But notice Jesus says, if anyone wants to be my disciple, this is an invitation that is open to all. Anyone can be Christ's disciple. Now, there are some who claim there's a difference between being a Christian and being a disciple, right? If you're a Christian, you're saved, but if you're a disciple, you're really serious about it. I don't see that distinction. I think it's a false distinction. If you are a follower of Jesus, you are a disciple. There is no such thing as being a Christian and not following Jesus. This is a call, really, to salvation. Think about it. The Great Commission says what? Go and make disciples of all nations. He doesn't say go and make converts. He doesn't say go and make Christians, because that word hadn't even been invented yet. Go and make disciples, those who will follow me. In fact, what are they supposed to do? They're supposed to obey everything I command them. Definition of a disciple. So Jesus is issuing an invitation to anybody who would follow him, they would be his disciple. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that there are works that have to be done in order to be a disciple. That's not the point. We are saved by grace through faith. That is the only way. But Jesus is saying, if you're really my disciple, you will obey my commands. If you're really my disciple, you will follow me. It's kind of a litmus test for discipleship. Now, the first part of Jesus' uncompromising demand seems very severe. What does he say? If anyone does not hate his father and mother, his wife and his children, his brothers and sisters, yes, his own life, he cannot be my disciple. You say, whoa, wait a minute. Are you serious, Jesus? Didn't you say love your enemies? Now you're saying hate your family? That doesn't make sense. Are we supposed to love everybody? What is he saying here? And the answer is no. There's no place in Jesus' teaching for literal hatred. He did command his followers to love their enemies, so obviously that doesn't square with the surface reading of this verse. But what he is saying is that devotion to himself can be nothing less than wholehearted. Discipleship means giving one's first loyalty to Jesus, and that trumps every earthly relationship. Now, in order to correctly understand what Jesus is saying here, we need to get back into his day and age. How did they use the word hate? It's very different than in 21st century America, where hate is an intense hostility or aversion that's usually derived from fear, anger, or some sense of injury. It can be an extreme dislike. It's a very emotional word. And that's not really the way that term was used in the time of the Bible. In fact, we are told back in Genesis chapter 25 that Esau despised his birthright when he sold it for a bowl of stew. It doesn't mean that he had intense negative emotions about his birthright. In fact, later on, he tried to get it back. He really wanted it. But he cared so little for it at the time. He was willing to sacrifice it for something we would say is rather trivial. Jesus did not want his disciples to cultivate a deep loathing for their parents, their spouse, their children, their friends. He called them to make a clear, decisive, definable choice to make him number one over all other relationships, even love for self. So the word hate does not mean a positive antagonism, but it really means to love less. Our love for Christ should be so strong that it seems like we hate the others by comparison. There's a parallel passage over in the Gospel of Matthew that I think will help. It's Matthew chapter 10, verse 37. Again, the words of Jesus. Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Here's where we get to the meaning. If any relationship on earth comes before Christ, we cannot be his disciple. And that means mother, father, husband or wife, children, grandchildren. Say, okay, now you're getting to meddling, right? Nothing can come before Christ. And I know, that's extreme. But that is the cost of discipleship. In a practical sense, discipleship means placing all of our other goals, objectives, plans, and personal desires below that of the Father. The truly committed follower of Jesus releases his own will while embracing the Father's will. Remember when Jesus was praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. And in Luke 22:42 it says, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me, yet not my will but yours be done. That is the attitude of someone who follows Jesus. Not my will, yours be done. Then Jesus also goes on there in Luke to say, you must carry your cross. Anyone who will not carry his cross cannot be my disciple. And what does that mean? It means that on a daily basis, we identify with Christ in shame, in suffering, in surrendering to God's will. See, that's what the cross was all about. I know we have these nice little crosses that we wear on our lapels or we put on a chain around our neck. You know, we adorn the church with the cross. And sometimes they're very beautiful. There wasn't anything beautiful about the cross in the first century. It was the worst possible way to die. Not only was it the most agonizing, it was also the most humiliating. There was shame attached to the suffering. And Jesus says, you must be willing to take on the shame and the suffering of being my disciple if you're going to follow me. It's not going to be glamorous. You're not always going to be praised. You're not always going to get patted on the back and say, wow, what a great person you are. To be a follower of Jesus often means being despised, being ridiculed, being isolated and shunned. Are we willing to do that? To be a follower of Jesus? It also means a death to self. Paul said, I am crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live. Meaning that it's no longer my plans, my agendas. It's His will. It's what it means to carry a cross. A cross is something we willingly accept from God as part of His will for our life. Now, I know some people, they'll talk about, oh, it's my cross to bear, right? It might be a physical ailment, or it might be noisy neighbors, or, whatever. Oh, that's my cross to bear. That just shows you have no idea what a cross is, right? Dietrich Bonhoeffer did know what that meant. He wrote in his, probably his best known work, The Call to Discipleship, Jesus bids a man to come and die. And that's very true. He went on to write, if our Christianity has ceased to be serious about discipleship, if we have watered down the gospel into emotional uplift, which makes no costly demands and which fails to distinguish between natural and Christian experience, then we cannot help but to regard the cross as an ordinary everyday calamity, as one of the trials and tribulations of life. If we think the little petty things that annoy us is our cross to bear, we got no clue what it means to carry a cross. Jesus says, if you want to be my disciple, you need to be willing to endure the shame, the suffering, and surrendering to my will. That's what carrying the cross is all about. Now, we don't all suffer the same way. Just look at our globe today. There are places where being a Christian can get you beaten, arrested, and even killed. Not every Christian is called to that. But we will encounter suffering. We will encounter the kind of rejection that Jesus did. Maybe not to the same degree, but we must be willing. Think about the story of Abraham when God told him to sacrifice his only son. Now, we know the end of the story. Abraham didn't at the time. And he went right up to the point of killing his son as a sacrifice to God. God said, stop. I now know you would not withhold even your only son. We are not all called to make that sacrifice. But if we were, would we be willing to do so? Maybe it's not that drastic. Maybe it's just your son or daughter, or maybe your grandson or granddaughter comes to you and says, I really think I want to be a police officer. And you get a lump in your throat. I want to join the military. Ooh. You really want to do that right now in this, the way our world is? It's a little scary. How about, I want to be a missionary to China. Whoa. I want to be a missionary to Nigeria, where Christians are being slaughtered by the thousands. We willing to give up our child, our grandchild, to that? That's what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. The demands are high. But as Jesus said in John 15:20, if they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you too. It's going to happen if our faith is for real. So if we have anything between us and Jesus, there's a problem. And that leads us to what I'm calling the underlying decree. This whole thing about hating one's family and carrying one's cross, it does sound a bit severe. Where would Jesus come up with such extreme views? Well, he actually went back to the scriptures. We see the underlying decree in all that Jesus is saying here in the very first of the Ten Commandments. You remember what that is? Exodus chapter 20 and verse 3. You shall have no other gods before me. God says, I must be number one. No other God before me. From the very beginning, God demanded first place in the lives of his people. Now, I know a lot of us are like, I don't have to worry about that one. You know, I don't have any idols in my life. Nope, that's good. No statues. You know, I'm not bowing down to anything else. I'm good. We read verses like 1 John 5:21. Dear children, keep yourselves from idols. And we're like, okay, got that one licked. Don't have an issue there. Until you read it in the New Living Translation, where it says, dear children, keep away from anything that takes God's place in your life. Uh-oh. Now, that's another story, right? See, it doesn't have to be a statue. It doesn't have to be an idol. It can be anything. It can be anyone that takes God's place in our life. That violates commandment one. See, that's the underlying decree here. It's exactly what Jesus is talking about with his uncompromising demand. No one, nothing should take precedence over Jesus. When it comes to devotion, he will not settle to be one of many. He must be the one and only, and nothing less will do. And that brings us to the ultimate decision. Again, Jesus is not using hard sell tactics here. He's not pushing people into making an emotional response. He's telling them, think about it first. Make sure you're ready before you make this commitment. He didn't want disciples that did not realize what they had gotten themselves into. Counting the cost is very important. So back in Luke 14, verse 28, he says, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, this fellow began to build, was not able to finish. Or suppose a king is about to go to war with another king. Will he not first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he's not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and ask for terms of peace. In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. This is a clear warning for those who are thinking of following Jesus without counting the cost. He's counseling the frivolous multitudes that were following him to calculate carefully the cost before following him. He sought only those who are willing to invest everything. In poker terms, we would say all in, right? Not holding anything back. That's what he wants from his disciples. Now, the point here is not that we all have to take vows of poverty. We can't enjoy the things God has blessed us with. That is not the point. It's to avoid the emotional attachments to those things. We can have things. Just don't let the things have us. That's the idea. Understand that things are used, people are loved, rather than the world's way, which uses people and loves things. Jesus says we've got to get that straight. In the realm of relationships, Christ comes first. When planning our lives, we subject all of our plans to the will of our King. And in terms of our possessions, we commit everything we have to him. Lord, they're yours. Which, by the way, they are anyway, right? Everything we have is his. He just lets us have it for a while. We can enjoy it, but they still belong to God, which means that at any time he can take them back, or he can take it from us and give it to somebody else. We can cry all we want, but God has the right to do that. If we can understand and accept that in advance, it might save us a lot of problems down the road. Hold things very loosely. It means recognizing that we are a steward, not an owner, of everything that we have. We thank God for the privilege of having them. We use them for His glory. We bless others with what God has given to us. But what we don't do is claim ownership. We don't say, "This is mine. You can't have it." The disciple of Jesus will not do that. Because the call to discipleship is a seriously calculated decision to surrender all that we are and all that we have to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. That's what Jesus meant when he talked about taking up one's own cross to follow him. That's why he demanded that we count the cost carefully. He's calling for an exchange of all that we have for all that he is. He was demanding implicit obedience, an unconditional surrender to his lordship. It is the only response that will open the gates of the kingdom. Seen through the eyes of the world, it's as high a price as anyone can pay. But from a kingdom perspective, it's really no sacrifice at all. As Jim Elliot, the missionary martyr, said so many years ago, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." So that's discipleship. Whatever we have on this earth, we can't keep it anyway. But to change that for what we cannot lose in eternity, I don't call that a sacrifice. I call that a good investment. These words condemn all half-heartedness. Now, Jesus is not discouraging discipleship here. He's just warning against the ill-considered, faint-hearted attachment in order that those who follow him may know the real thing. He wants us to count the cost, to reckon as lost all things for his sake, so that we can really enter the exhilaration of full-blooded discipleship, to really know what that is. Because I want to tell you something. There are very few people, maybe no one on earth, more miserable than a half-hearted Christian. Because there's something inside them that says, you know, it should be better than this. People out in the world, they're enjoying the sin. But those who have only gone halfway with Christ, they are among the most miserable. It's only when we give it all to Christ that we know what it is all about. Unfortunately, though, that is not the gospel that's being preached today. As John Stott puts it, the Christian landscape is strewn with the wreckage of derelict, half-built towers, the ruins of those who began to build and were unable to finish. For thousands of people still ignore Christ's warning and undertake to follow him without first pausing to reflect on the cost to do so. The result is the great scandal of Christianity today, so-called nominal Christians. In countries to which Christian civilization has spread, large number of people have covered themselves with a decent but thin veneer of Christianity. They have allowed themselves to be somewhat involved, enough to be respectable, but not enough to be uncomfortable. Their religion is a great soft cushion. It protects them from the hard unpleasantness of life while changing its place and shape to suit their convenience. No wonder cynics speak of hypocrites in the church and dismiss religion as escapism. That's what Jesus was trying to avoid. He didn't want half-hearted people claiming to be his followers. If you're going to be a follower of Jesus, then go for it. Otherwise, don't even start. Don't pretend to be if you're not really going to do it. Jesus makes total demands of his followers. If you're determined to live a life of easygoing self-indulgence, then take my advice and steer well clear of Christianity. Jesus is definitely not for you. Jesus says, come, but think it over first. He doesn't want half-hearted followers whose commitment sways with every emotional wind. You're either a loyal disciple of Christ or you're a lost sinner. There is no distinction. You're either one or the other. Jesus says, come. Just think it over first. Would you bow with me in prayer? Lord Jesus, you have made your demands very clear. You will settle for nothing less than all. All of our devotion, all that we are and all that we have. But you give us so much more back in return. It truly is a good investment. It's a fair exchange. I pray that we would examine our own lives, our own commitment. Is there anything that gets in the way of completely following you? Is there anything that we would hold on to if it came down to you or that? May we dispose of such idols in our lives and give our complete, wholehearted allegiance to you. And may the world see that we are indeed your disciples and not those who are just playing a game. We pray this in your name. Amen.